History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In 20th century American history, some of the most important yet overlooked people have been the U.S. Secret Service. That's because them failing at their job could alter the course of American history, which it did in 1963 when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. But if you look into Secret Service history, it's hard not to be impressed at how many assassinations they prevented. Every president, and essentially every presidential candidate, has been on the receiving end of hundreds of death threats, and there have been dozens of times that they were stalked for hours or days or even weeks. In the milieu in which the Secret Service operates, bodyguards have witnessed the terrors of election campaigns when presidential candidates have waded into crowds to shake hands with their supporters, rode in open-air cars, and made sudden but risky changes to their schedules, oblivious to the fact that in every campaign there have been people stalking candidates with ill intent. Sometimes they're mentally ill, sometimes they're failed upstarts at life and they want to make a name for themselves. Bodyguards have also witnessed embarrassing moments in a candidate's campaign and how intrusive they've been at the most delicate of moments. Today, I'm joined by book author Mel Eitan, author of Protecting the Presidential Candidates, from JFK to Biden. We'll talk about all sorts of moments in Secret Service history from JFK onward, such as why JFK's personal life put him in danger, why Lyndon Johnson was given an FBI agent personal bodyguard following the assassination of JFK, how Reagan's would-be assassin, John Hinckley, attempted to shoot Ted Kennedy 4 months before he targeted President Reagan, showing that some people don't care who they kill or from what party they kill somebody, just that they kill somebody prominent, the story of how Richard Nixon used a Secret Service bodyguard to spy on Ted Kennedy, the serious plot to assassinate presidential candidate Jesse Jackson, threats to assassinate presidential candidates during the 1996, 2000, 2004, 2008, and 2012 campaigns, and continuing threats to Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden. This is an underreported but ongoing reality for anyone who seeks high office, and it's something that has changed significantly over the decades, but also remained remarkably similar. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Mel Eitan. Mel, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back again, Scott. Yes.
It's been interesting in the past having conversations with you because you've looked through the records of the Secret Service responsible for protecting the President of the United States, his family, and other high-profile figures. And what you get out of that are people who really see our presidents at their most honest moments. They let their guard down, the Secret Service stand around, and they become sort of like furniture in the Oval Office. So for politicians who are engaged in a profession that's mostly artifice and keeping up a false appearance, you actually get a real look at them. So before we get into the details of your new book on people who guard presidential candidates and stories and assassination attempts therein, I wonder, are politicians, is their public persona always opposite from their private persona, or are there politicians who still manage to be genuine in a disingenuous profession?
Sometimes, Scott. It all depends on the candidate. It all depends on the president. The Secret Service, get a real insight into the personalities and characters of candidates and presidents. Secret Service agents have spoken quite a lot about the candidates that they, by the way, you can't always say all of the Secret Service agents you've got at a president or candidate are in agreement. What you can say is that, you know, something like the majority of agents are in agreement about a various candidate or president. I'll give you an example. With few exceptions, all of the agents who guarded Reagan spoke well of him and said that what you see is what you get. He was a genuine character. That doesn't apply for all candidates, of course, or all presidents. There are other presidents who, where the agents were in disagreement, for example. Take Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson had a few agents who respected him, who thought he was a nice man, but the vast majority described him as a bully, narcissistic, sometimes had uncontrollable rages against agents. So it varies from candidate to candidate and president to president. I would say that most presidents that agents speak about, they had respect for. They thought that they were genuine. and they were of good character. But as I say, there are some, quite a lot of agents who are in agreement that the opposite applies. For example, many agents spoke of how Bill Clinton was pretty false in his character. He was an amiable guy, is an amiable guy. You know, he's not an ogre, but at the same time, everything he did was for political reasons. The opposite applied, as I said, with Reagan. George Bush, what you see is what you've got. He was very, George H.W. Bush was very, very much liked by his agents. And depending on which president, let's talk about Nixon. Nixon was a little remote from most of his agents, but there are a few who speak of him as having a sense of humor, having an amiability about him. But on the whole, Nixon did keep his distance.
What you focus on in your book are presidential candidates. And I remember reading an article in Newsweek several years ago about the 2004 presidential election between George Bush and John Kerry. And it noted that once John Kerry received the Democratic Party presidential nomination, overnight, his security detail changed. There was a permanent security detail around him. They could stop traffic for him if necessary. We know about the security detail and the Secret Service around presidents, but when does this begin to be applied to presidential candidates as well?
Well, clearly, it's decided by a group of people, including leaders in Congress, who is suitable for Secret Service protection. It depends on the primary system, when you go through, you know, percentage of the votes. So that decision is made, but it isn't consistent. It never is. It can't be consistent because you're dealing with different personalities, different characters, and you're dealing with different candidates who have different levels of threats. For example, President Obama, when he was a candidate, he received protection nearly a year before the election. The same applied with a number of other candidates, Ted Kennedy, for example, because of the amount of threats that they received. So it depends on all of these things. The vast majority of candidates, as you probably know, will drop out after the, you know, Iowa or New Hampshire, so that they aren't in the campaign for very long. These candidates, before they qualify for Secret Service protection, will either hire their own private bodyguards, private security firms, or they, if they are governors, they would already have state police protecting them. So, and some will drop out even before they reach that level of acquiring their own security. You must realize too that there are some people who run for president simply to enhance their profile when it comes to running for re-election as senator or congressman or governor, and they really don't have any chance of attaining the nomination of the Republican or Democratic Party's nomination. So there you have it, Scott.
Well, that's very true. Having come from Iowa, I can affirm that in the run-up to the Iowa caucuses, there are some presidential candidates who will be in that state for a full year. They'll be going to diners and meatpacking plants and eating fried butter on a stick at the Iowa State Fair. You can walk up to them very easily. That's sort of the nature of the beast at that point. Well, seeing how this modern approach to security evolves, the watershed moment is, of course, the assassination of JFK. Something you point out is that it not only changed protecting presidents and presidential candidates, but perhaps the course of American history itself. Let's start there. What do you mean by that?
Well, in terms of the Secret Service, it certainly changed American history. Not only changed American history in the sense that Lyndon Johnson took over and he had a different agenda in many ways. But in terms of the Secret Service, of course, it was a terrible shock, and that they never lived it down. Even today, you have Secret Service agents who were there at the time and who are still alive, who still have nightmares about it. I mean, it certainly changed American history.
The other Kennedy that you mentioned in your book is Edward Kennedy, and you note that Secret Service agents were very nervous guarding him. What was the reason for that?
Well, you have to remember that going back to the 60s, you had the JFK assassination, You had Lee Harvey Oswald as the assassin. Lee Harvey Oswald became part of American culture in a sense. Not a month went by when some media outlet, including especially the print press, you know, was mentioning the assassination, mentioning Lee Harvey Oswald. That inspired a lot of would-be assassins because you had many mentally ill people who were nobodies. They wanted to be somebody. And there were a lot of copycat acts going on at the time. So with the assassination of JFK and then the assassination of Robert Kennedy, of course, Ted Kennedy was especially vulnerable. People wanted to be, you know, Sirhan Sirhan most definitely wanted to be the second Kennedy assassination. You know, he wanted to gate crash into history, not only because, you know, he committed his act, not only because of personal reasons that he was, you know, he'd lived a failed life, nobody who wanted to be a somebody, but he was also fanatical in his politics. Then you had Ted Kennedy, and of course, you know, the reporters who followed Ted Kennedy, the media was saying, all was saying, in 1968, 72, 76, he finally jumped in for the 1980 election, and the reporters were always saying, you know, they looked upon his following him as a death watch because there was someone out there. Even Kennedy himself said, you know, there's someone else out there who's going to blow my head off, or words to that effect. In 1968, you know, as a Kennedy, he could have had the Democratic nomination. I mean, most historians would agree on that. He was far too young. He was only 36 years old at the time. And thereafter, after Chappaquiddick, though, in 1969, he knew that his career had been damaged. And so he decided against it in 72, 76, but he finally went for it in 1980. And we know what happened then. Jimmy Carter, who was president, beat him in the primaries.
You mentioned the Kennedys and how them as a family were a magnet, but then there are also assassination plots against Gary Hart, Jesse Jackson when he runs in 1988, later Bill Clinton. I wonder, for presidential candidates, are they simply a magnetic pull to all of the people in the United States who suffer from bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, who are not mentally well, and when they see someone on television, it triggers something where they believe that it's a moral or justifiable act to attempt to assassinate them. And there's a certain percentage of the population that will always be that. And for whatever reason, high-profile politicians, or maybe celebrities as well, will exert a magnetic pull on those people and bring them out of the woodwork. Is that a sense that you got as you're seeing where it seems like clockwork? There are assassinations that come out as presidential campaigns get underway, or are there certain types of candidates who have been under more heat than other candidates?
Well, nearly all of the would-be assassins I've researched come under two categories, or they come under both categories. One is the personal, that they may have mental ill health, and the political is that they are fanatical about their fanatics on the right and the left. For example, you know, people, members of the Posse Comitatus, which is a right-wing group, targeted Nelson Rockefeller. You also had Jesse Jackson. That was a political plot for a couple in Missouri. They are a member of Christian Identity, which is a right-wing plot. But you have the, you know, the left wing. The political side of Sirhan Sirhan was he was a Palestinian fanatic. So you'll have would-be assassins out there every campaign, and it'll be either one or both of those categories, or and it will be the candidate who creates the most excitement, the most electricity in a campaign. And if you look at the number of threats, you'll see the likes of Kennedy, Reagan, just attracting love and hate in equal measure. And that also attracts, you know, the threats and the plots and the assassination attempts.
So you see the amount of excitement that a candidate generates, regardless of ideology, will attract a similar amount of danger from assassins?
Yes, there are some assassins where, you know, it's psychodrama they're involved in. It's not political drama. For example, the act itself is more important than, you know, any politics they might have, for example. And an example of that would be Arthur Bremer, who stalked both Nixon at one time, gave up stalking Nixon, but he followed him all the way to Ottawa. And then Arthur Bremer set his sights on George Wallace. So there are two different types of politics there, you know, the right and the, well, Nixon was kind of a moderate. And you have Hinckley. Hinckley stalked Jimmy Carter, a Democrat. He waited outside Ted Kennedy's office for 3 hours waiting for Kennedy. Thankfully, Kennedy was held on Senate business in the Capitol, and he left. But, you know, he targeted Kennedy, Jimmy Carter first, then Ted Kennedy. And then eventually, as we all know, in March of 1981, he shot Reagan.
I think Kennedy's secretary had a code word in case there was a suspicious person around. Is that right?
There was. She arranged that with the Capitol Police, and she'd pick up the phone and use the code word, and she had to use it on a number of occasions. Two occasions were for a woman called Susan Osgood. She suffered from mental health problems, and she'd been in hospital a number of times, and arrived at Kennedy's office with a large knife and wanted to gain entry to Kennedy's office. Kennedy was there at the time. And at that particular time, he was running, he'd announced his candidacy, or it might have been shortly before. So he did have Secret Service protection. Jimmy Carter insisted on that because of the position that Ted Kennedy was in with regard to threats as being the third Kennedy brother. Susan Osgood was tackled by Joseph Meusberger. He managed to get a cut. He was cut by the knife. But she was arrested, and eventually she was tried. And then the other one was a community activist in Washington, D.C., an African-American woman, who was pestering Kennedy's office for help with a community project. She didn't get any satisfaction, so there was an incident there where she grappled with Kennedy's workers. Kennedy actually quite magnanimously, you know, spoke to her, calmed her down, and she left. But a little while later, it was clear that she'd been suffering from mental health problems, and she started to threaten not only Kennedy, but Kennedy's secretary, Melody Miller.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. There's a interesting method that Richard Nixon used to spy on Ted Kennedy using a Secret Service bodyguard to do so. How did he do this, and what were the results of it?
Well, it was suggested by Bob Haldeman, you know, Nixon's Praetorian Guard, chief of staff. And there was someone who, a Secret Service agent who worked for Nixon when he was vice president. And they thought he could do their bidding. It's been mentioned in a few books that he was Nixon's spy and all of that. But the truth eventually came out. He was playing them along. He was playing Haldeman and Ehrlichman along, and he never really intended giving the lowdown on Ted Kennedy, as it were. So that little spying operation by Nixon didn't really work out.
Are there surprising near misses from this time period where you mentioned a couple of cases in which an assassin was outside of Ted Kennedy's office, but are there other cases that a plan almost happened but was foiled, or last minute changes in scheduling prevented disaster from happening?
I think if you look at, speaking generally, I think if you look at most of the campaigns, there's been some kind of incident like that. Gary Hart, for example, when he ran in 84, the Secret Service foiled a plot to this guy who was waiting outside a hotel for Gary Hart. And, you know, that plot was foiled. But Jesse Jackson as well. There are so many plots. There are literally, you're talking about, Jesse Jackson received 300 threats in his 84 and 88 campaign for the presidency. Not all of them were serious. I mean, you know, you have to look at these threats as some were some guy shouting off in a bar that he was going to kill the candidate. Others were nearly serious or quite serious, but they didn't have, if they didn't have proximity to the candidate. I mean, the Secret Service look at a lot of things about the would-be assassin or the threat net. Does he have access to weapons? Does he have any mental health problems? Has he been hospitalized? Is he in the vicinity of the candidate during the, you know, the campaign tours? So all of these things come into play to assess whether the actual threat. So if I say that, you know, Jesse Jackson had 300 threats, not all of them would be serious, but there would be some to initiate a Secret Service investigation. And during the investigation, the plot is foiled. You also have the help of the public that, you know, the Secret Service, like the FBI and any local police department or state police, will have informants. And they use informants an awful lot.
When I see images of security detail around a president or remember video clips, I think of Bill Clinton going on jogs in the 90s or George W. Bush doing the same. He's surrounded by an entourage of the G-men and their sunglasses, covering and sort of cocooning him. If everything is working well and a president doesn't give a security detail the slip, which I know JFK and Bill Clinton did on numerous occasions for their liaisons, are they supposed to be in a protective cocoon all the time?
Well, there's always a tension between the Secret Service and the candidate or the president. And the tension is that no president or no candidate likes to be restricted in their movements. There's always a negotiation going on between the protectors and the protectee. And they come to a compromise. I mean, most presidents really adhere to the advice of the agent in charge of the White House detail. Some are not so, as you mentioned before there, JFK, Bill Clinton, Nixon once escaped from his detail. So, you know, there are stories like this. These things happen. Generally speaking, they do adhere to the advice of the Secret Service, most of them.
How have the operations of the Secret Service changed over the multi-decade period that you look at in your book from the 60s up into the 21st century? Are their operations similar, except maybe larger and more technologically sophisticated, or are they fundamentally different somehow?
Totally different. And the spur, of course, was the JFK assassination. Radical changes. Let's take transport, for example. You know, you had the open-top limousine through Dallas. That was changed in that you couldn't have an open top. But then again, as I mentioned before, you had the tensions between what the president wanted and what the Secret Service wanted. So you would see in 1964, a year after the assassination, Lyndon Johnson standing up in an open-top limousine campaigning. So he just, you know, the Warren Commission report, for example, criticized the Secret Service, but also initiated changes. And Lyndon Johnson did not adhere to those changes. And as the Secret Service agent said, you can advise, but you can't force a president to do what he doesn't want to do. But those changes gradually became more and more acceptable with presidents, certainly after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, then the shooting of George Wallace in 72. Nixon still did, you know, now and again, Nixon would do that too. He rode through an open-top limousine in Cairo, for example, with President Sadat. He'd stand, during the 72 campaign, he would stand, you know, on his car and, you know, give the V for victory sign, while student demonstrators were around throwing rocks. Now again, you'd have presidents do foolhardy things. As time has gone by, though, you'll see that more and more severe security strictures are coming in. And I think technology also has changed drastically. And it's changed drastically with the potential for assassination. If you think about it, you have autonomous weapons now. You know, they're actually, you know, on the dark net, you can buy them. How do you battle against that? It's extremely risky now. You've got weapons which are far superior than what the they were 50 or 60 years ago. You have terrorism now, which is a danger. So it's changed in that sense as well. So the Secret Service have to keep up, just like the military. They have to keep up with changes in technology. There's also changes in, you know, the internet, social media as well. You've got, you know, more threats going on because of social media. I think an awful lot of people don't understand. An awful lot of these threateners have not realized that you can't just go on social media and start saying, I'd like to kill, you know, this candidate, or I'd like to kill this president. And a lot of them don't realize that, you know, that there is a strict law against doing that. And there's been quite a few threateners. They may have been in a bar and they've seen the candidate or the president on TV and they've made threats. The police have been tipped off. They've been arrested. There's been a court case. And they've ended up doing time in prison. You mentioned Bill Clinton before. Bill Clinton, with his jogging sessions around the White House, he was stalked by a man with a 38 pistol who could have easily have gotten off a shot. One reason or another, it's a long story, but you'll read it in the book. You know, he didn't go ahead with his plans, but he confessed his plans to someone else that he knew. That the police were tipped off, the Secret Service were tipped off, and he ended up doing time in prison. So there's more availability to make threats through social media, but a lot of people should simply realize you just can't do that.
Right. Very easy way to get a FBI knock at your door. I wonder, looking in the 21st century, the ease, but also the new challenges that come, because as you mentioned, on the one hand, you can scan for social media of people making death threats, whereas if it were 1970 and there was a loud barfly in this town in southern Michigan who always talked loudly about wanting to kill Nixon and shouting to anyone who would listen to him after he's been drinking for a while, unless the local authority hears about that no one would really get wind of it, whereas now he could go on to Twitter or Facebook and spout that all the time and trigger some red flags. On the other hand, I could also see someone becoming radicalized online or groups assembling in ways that they couldn't in the past. So what do you see as the challenges, but also new tools that security detail has in the 21st century?
Well, you know, as I say in my book, you can't call out the National Guard every time, you know, you have demonstrations against presidents. You know, America is an open society. It's democracy. And any threat to that democracy has to be concerning. So I would say that the future threats would be, as I've mentioned before, if you've got artificial intelligence and that artificial intelligence is applied to weaponry, you know, everyone faces a grave risk.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Coming into the 21st century, there is a scandal that happens, or multiple scandals that happen during Barack Obama's presidency. What are some of those?
Well, a lot of them involved ill-considered acts by some agents, and by no means that, you know, the vast majority of Secret Service agents are dedicated men and women who, you know, live by their oath to protect the candidate or the president. But now and again, you will have some sad behavior, like in Colombia, for example, when Obama was president. And, you know, there was instance with prostitutes and drinking. But, you know, these are disciplinary problems which the Secret Service has dealt with. And I wouldn't say that it's happening more now than it has in the past. You know, you'll always have the bad apples in any organization.
In 2016, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, there were assassination fears against them. Can you tell me about these?
Well, with Hillary Clinton, you know, you have, like, it's part of the culture wars. America is dividing along really right, left lines more than any other time. And this is reflected in, you know, social media. It's reflected in Hollywood, you know, so-called celebrities mouthing off about a candidate. And, you know, it seeps down and people think that if they are saying it, I'll say it too. As we've discussed previously, you know, it's not a very good thing for anyone to do. You know, there's less of a sense of civility within American politics now. And that was reflected in, you know, the 2016 election on both sides. And unless America can get back to this doing politics where you had Republicans who were friends with Democrats, you know, I can't see it changing.
In a society, 330 million people, it would be almost impossible to imagine a president or a presidential candidate returning to, say, the state of security affairs during Abraham Lincoln's presidency, when there are accounts of people essentially walking up to the White House and knocking on the door and talking to the president. Yes, they do have to go through one or two levels of security, but it is a completely different galaxy compared to what it is today. From all the accounts that you've read, do you think things are going to continue to get more and more contained and the president or presidential candidates living more in a walled-off garden? Or is there a method that they could have some sort of personal access to the public that they represent?
I think whenever you have a period of upset within American society and American politics, for example, if you look back to the 68 election, when you had anti-Vietnam War demonstrators, if you had the race problem, which you know divided America very strongly, and you had the assassination of Martin Luther King, and then 2016, you had the same turmoil going on between left and right. When you have a society on that level, inevitably, it is going to trickle down and people are going to get more and more excited. They are going to act out their fantasies of wanting to see, you know, solace in threatening a candidate. So the future, it depends on whether American society can get back to what it used to be. You know, as I said, you had, you know, Democratic senators who have, I've met quite a few of these senators. I've met a few candidates as well. And, you know, I've seen them together, Republican senators and Democratic senators, and they are very friendly. One example is Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy. But now it seems that the line is drawn. And if you have the line drawn between left and right, it inevitably will result in, you know, a less comfortable arena for future presidential elections.
Well, this is a great window into the private behaviors of a lot of famous politicians. And this has been reading your other book and this one too, a great way to psychologically profile these different people in ways that you don't quite get if you look at official press material or what their press spokesman or spokeswoman try to present themselves to the public. So I've really seen this as very useful. And for listeners who want to check out your book, the name is Protecting the Presidential Candidates from JFK to Biden. Mel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.